You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out what one Wisconsin nonprofit is doing to provide assistance to people affected by this weekend's earthquake in Ecuador.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 ordered an end to racial segregation in American schools. But more than 60 years later, Milwaukee and other major cities still see high levels of segregation in their schools.
One question left open by that court decision was how schools should be desegregated. There were a number of approaches taken, but the one that captured public attention and media attention, especially in the North, was busing, transporting African-American students to mostly white schools. From the 1950s and the 1970s, busing became a major controversy. It was ultimately rejected by political leaders, from presidential candidate Ronald Reagan to then-Senator Joe Biden. Our next guest says in order to change segregation in today's schools, we need to take a closer look at why busing dominated that debate. Matthew Delmont joins us now. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University, and his latest book is Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the story you tell in your book, why is it important to try to understand this whole busing controversy, now in 2016?
Well, I think we live with many of the problems that emerged from the busing controversy of the 1970s. Our schools are still largely segregated on the basis of race and socioeconomic status. But I don't think most people understand what was attempted with busing in the first place and why there was so much resistance to it. So in trying to do this research, I was trying to really ground our contemporary policy debates in a firm story about what actually happened historically.
Well, how do we get from Brown versus the Board of Education to busing as the centerpiece of desegregation of schools?
Well, busing comes up as a court-ordered way to force school districts that have been recalcitrant, that have resisted school desegregation, to force them to take some sort of meaningful steps to integrate their schools. So the language of busing actually emerges as a way to resist school desegregation efforts. So most people associate busing with BOSS in the 1970s, but busing actually starts as a term that gets debated politically in the 1950s in New York. And it starts with a group of white parents who are opposed to the idea of black and Puerto Rican students being sent from minority schools to schools in white neighborhoods in Queens. So we actually have this language of busing, this opposition to busing emerging before school districts are really considering busing as a meaningful tactic. But then when you start to see court orders in the 1970s in Boston, eventually in Milwaukee, busing is being used as a way to try to force these school districts to make some sort of meaningful steps to integrate their schools.
Yeah, and you write that before what we now think of as busing started, actually often black students were being bused away from white districts. And that didn't get that kind of level of national controversy.
Exactly. So throughout the book, I actually use the term busing in quotation marks, because I think once busing becomes a political term, it misses the fact that buses had been used for generations in American schools. And actually, school buses are what make possible the modern American school districts that we still know today. It makes possible having larger, comprehensive high schools, makes possible for students to be able to travel distances from their rural schools to suburban and urban schools. And in fact, buses had been used to maintain school segregation in the years before the Brown decision and the years immediately following. So the language of busing as a way to oppose school desegregation misses the fact that school buses were used for a variety of purposes, but also to, in some cases, maintain segregated schools.
Talking to Matthew Delmont, he's the author of the new book, Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Let's get to this battle that didn't start, but really erupted in many ways in the 1970s. Matthew, the civil rights movement, we think of as a Southern issue in a lot of ways, but this busing story and this school desegregation story we're talking about here, in most ways, it seems like it was an urban Northern phenomenon.
It was. And I think one of the things that was hard for people to recognize in these northern cities was that segregation, racism, was not just a Southern issue. It wasn't something that was just happening in Little Rock and Selma and Montgomery, but it was happening in Boston and Chicago and New York. And there were grassroots civil rights movements in each of those cities, and in Milwaukee as well, that they were there for decades before the 1970s. But the school districts that become the dominant stories for busing are all these northern districts, because they're the ones that hold out the longest in terms of doing anything about integrating their schools. Boston becomes the most famous example, because the Boston School Committee there, led at times by Luis de Hicks, who becomes a kind of a figurehead of the white backlash, they resist any meaningful efforts for over two decades to address school segregation in the city. So by the time Judge Arthur Garrity makes the decision in Boston in 1974 that it's going to be busing, the school district, the school board at that point had already resisted doing anything for years, and that's part of the reason it emerges as this crisis story. And I think one of the problems I have with how people remember that Boston story is that the story in Boston was really the fact that the schools had been intentionally segregated, and the court order was meant to address that fact. But people tend to focus just on the fact that there was a tremendous amount of anger and animosity about the busing order itself, but that misses what was going on in the two decades before 1974.
Yeah, a lot of the story you tell in this book is how busing was framed, and you say the way the debate was made, the arguments were made, and the way the media presented them, it turned it from the civil rights of black children to the preferences of white parents. How did that happen?
It happened in two ways. One, the people who were opposed to school desegregation in the North, these are white parents and politicians, they were very close students of the African-American civil rights movement. So whereas television played a really positive role in terms of framing African-American civil rights, particularly the Southern movement, and bringing that to a national audience, by the 1960s and 70s, you have primarily white parents who are against busing getting a lot of positive news coverage. And that's because they're framing their opposition to busing in a language, in a set of protest tactics that look very much like the Southern movement. So having large-scale public protests with a lot of women and children and American flags, clearly marked placards. And I think most importantly, they never say that they're opposed to sending their kids to school with black or Puerto Rican or Latino students. What they say is we're in favor of neighborhood schools. We're trying to protect our rights. These are our civil rights that they're fighting for. That language resonated really powerfully through the media and helped to make their case against busing. From the media's perspective, they gave a lot of positive coverage to these white parents because for a lot of the northern media locations, whether it's the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, or the national broadcast networks, they just couldn't believe that segregation could exist in these northern cities. So they never thought of civil rights in the North as being as morally urgent of an issue as it was in the South. So when it came time to cover these issues when they came north, they were working from a very fuzzy understanding of what racism looked like in their own cities, and therefore they covered the issue in a way that was more favorable to the people who were opposing school desegregation.
Yeah, you put a lot of attention to the TV media in particular at the time, and whereas in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, there was a lot of focus on the individual black students, the Little Rock Nine, you know, still live on in legend, and very little, you write, in fact, some left on the cutting room floor when it came to African-American students in the North in these desegregation battles.
Yeah, one of the interesting things for me in working on this project is I watched hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage of how the nightly news broadcasts on ABC, CBS, and NBC covered these stories. And what was amazing to me is all of this footage, hours and hours and hours of it, focus on white parents and white neighborhoods that are angry about busing, and you see just a few seconds, a few short clips of the black students whose rights were actually at stake in these cases. And I think part of what was going on is that the white parents who were opposed to busing, they were the most forthright in their complaints. They offered the best sound bites. They had the best sort of media personas that were attractive to television news broadcasts. They made the story compelling to viewers. Whereas by the 1970s, I think there was a sense that the African-American civil rights story had sort of run its course. It wasn't interesting to viewers in the same way. So what TV ended up doing was talking more about the backlash among white parents rather than focusing on who were these black students who were being bused and what were the sort of constitutional issues that were at stake. I mean, because fundamentally, busing was about the constitutional rights of black students, but it ended up being framed about the anger and frustration of white parents.
Would you say that busing, in effect, became a code word for a northern form of discrimination, of intentional racism?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that was interesting for me in doing the research is understanding how that very language got written into things like the Civil Rights Act. So when the 1964 Civil Rights Act is being debated, the northern, midwestern, and western senators, they explicitly include language that defines segregation as being something that's occurring in the South, and it defines what they call racial imbalance in the North as being something that the federal government is not going to pursue. That matters because it ends up being the case that the federal authorities turn their attention to southern school districts, but it leaves the school districts in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, and lets them off the hook because they're defining segregation as being something that doesn't exist in those cities. That's a problem. It ends up being false that there was intentional segregation in many of these cities, but the laws were written in such a way that it made it incredibly difficult to prosecute those cases.
We're talking to Matthew Delmont. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University, and we're talking about his latest book. It's called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Were you a part of this debate over school desegregation and busing back in the 1970s? What did you think about it then? And today, is your school district heavily segregated or not? And what's the solution to modern-day school segregation? Call 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we continue our conversation now with Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University. His latest book is called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you part of the debate over school desegregation, over busing back in the 70s? Is this an issue in your life now, in your local school, in your community? Is your local school still really segregated? What, if anything, should we be doing about that? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go right to our callers now. Carrie is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Carrie, hi.
Hello, this is Carrie. I'm calling because in my neighborhood, which is a very diverse neighborhood, my daughter, we chose to send her to our actual neighborhood school, but a lot of our neighbors choose to send their children to maybe a Montessori school or a less diverse school, and I just think that people don't understand the benefits of sending their kids to urban schools that are diverse, and I think it's just still really a problem, and that she's really benefiting from going to the school, and people just don't understand that.
Carrie, thanks for that call. And private schools, Matthew, I know that was part of a lot of communities' answer to desegregation. I know in the South, I don't know about the North, is new private schools opened up. Was that part of the story you were looking into?
Yeah, it's a small part of the story I tell that, particularly in the South, you had a wave of private schools opening up, what they ended up calling, critics ended up calling segregation academies as a way for parents who opposed school desegregation efforts and who had the resources to be able to send their kids to private schools to send them to these largely white private schools. You see some of that in the North, but it really is a Southern phenomenon.
Carrie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Marlon in Madison. Marlon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marlon?
Oh, well, I participated in two different periods of the busing program in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm actually a school teacher in Madison, Wisconsin, currently. And so when I first participated in the busing program, I was in second grade. And I initially started the school year going to, at the time it was called Victor Berger Elementary School. And then there was lots of interest in sending kids out to suburban schools. And so when we were asked by our family if me and some of my friends would like to go to this school, we were saying, sure. They were saying it's all about integration. We didn't even know what integration was, but we thought it was cool. So when we got to school on our first day, we were picketed by all the neighbors out there. And so we didn't realize that when we got there, we weren't actually going to be mixed in the classrooms with white kids, and we weren't. We were all separated. So it was two buses. One bus of black students went into one classroom, and then my bus and our kids in our bus went into a second separate classroom with also all blacks only.
And Marlon, you said that was your first experience with busing. What was your second?
Right. And that was at Grantosa, 82nd Street School on 82nd and Grantosa in Milwaukee. My second experience was, I was much older when I was in high school, and I was with the 220 busing program, and I caught the bus out to Bayview High School. It would take me a long time to get to school. It would take me about an hour and a half one way. But I loved it because it was part of the magnet program that Milwaukee schools had. I don't know if they still do because I've been in Madison for 21 years now.
Marlon, thanks a lot for sharing your stories. I want to bring Matthew Delmont back into this now. So sounds like Marlon was part of what I think might have been unique in Milwaukee, this intact busing program. Can you talk about that, Matthew?
Sure, yeah, I'm glad the caller mentioned that. So Milwaukee was unique in having this program they called Intact Busing, which meant, just as your caller described, they sent African-American students from predominantly black schools and black neighborhoods to white schools, but the students weren't actually integrated in those schools. They were in separate classrooms, in some cases separate lunchrooms, separate recess times. So it was kind of a bizarre scenario where they are counted as integration in terms of the demographics of the overall school, but the experience itself was not at all integrated. But I think Milwaukee is also interesting, as the caller mentioned, that it did have some success with magnet school programs. It had some success with vouchers, but also the sense that all the research that we have about these school segregation efforts is once they were given a chance to actually work, they worked to the benefit of black students, and they usually did not negatively impact white students at all. It did often put the onus on black students to travel a great distance from their home, but the students who went through the programs, the scholars who have studied this, have found it had long-term benefits in terms of the educational opportunities and the long-term life chances of African-American students.
Marlon mentioned being picketed when he and his classmates arrived at these white schools. But you also write that civil rights activists were protesting this because it was this still a separate classroom within this other school.
Yeah, it was exactly the opposite of what civil rights activists wanted to see happen. They wanted black students to be transported to schools with better resources and have an integrated experience, not to be transported and sort of make the kind of southern model of Jim Crow evident in a Milwaukee school where you have a white classroom and a black classroom. So it was exactly what they did not want to see happen. And the kind of picketing that your caller was talking about, people often ask, what did African Americans think about busing? And honestly, it was a complicated set of emotions because in many cases, students were being transported to neighborhoods and schools where they encountered hostility and racism. So in many cases, African Americans ended up lobbying more for resources back to African American schools to not have to go into these hostile environments.
Marlon, thanks for that call. We're talking to Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University. His newest book is Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Go to another caller now with Jim on the line in Winchester. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I was a elementary school in the 70s. I went to Wilson and Wilson and Hawthorne. My parents moved into that neighborhood specifically because of the distances. It was less than a block to Wilson, two blocks to Hawthorne, and a mile to East. And I can remember my parents fighting the busing because, if I remember correctly, it was going to be the same number of students would have to leave our school that were being bused in. I don't ever remember implementation of this, but I do remember the fights that my parents would go to the PTA meetings and that they were trying to stop the kids from going out. That was their main concern, is the whole reason they moved to this neighborhood was to be in close proximity to these schools.
Jim, thanks for that call. And did it work out that way, Matthew, that as students, black students were being bused into white schools, white students were being bused elsewhere?
It depended on the community. In some places, there were mostly one-way busing programs. We had African-American students bused to white schools. In many cases, those were protested as well. The white parents didn't want black students coming into their schools, even if it was a one-way program. But the more contentious programs were two-way busing efforts. And I think, as your caller mentioned, these were controversial because they impacted where people lived and what they perceived to be their rights as homeowners and as parents to send their kids to the closest schools. And they caused some inconvenience to people. I think the challenge it forced people to sort of deal with was how to share the question of opportunities and burdens with regards to education across a citywide level. And the problem with a lot of the residential basis for school decisions was so much of our residential housing patterns were based on discriminatory housing practices in the first place, that the tying schools directly to where people could live ended up reinforcing a lot of discriminatory practices from the past.
Time for one more call. Justine in Milwaukee is with us now. Justine, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to give you a quick call and give you my input. I was actually a part of busing back in the 70s. My family and I moved from a suburb of Milwaukee back into Milwaukee to take care of my grandmother. And so I was bused to a school that required a 45-minute ride from where I lived to the school, a bus ride to the school every day. And while I would say that I learned a lot about different cultures and how to accept people. I mean, I grew up where color wasn't an issue, so it wasn't a big difference. But I will say that most of the time in the classroom was spent dealing with the conflict between the two races. So I remember a lot of issues that happened that year with the different races. Mm-hmm. I don't remember anything that I learned in that school.
Justine, thanks for that call. A little low on time now. Matthew, was this a common people reporting conflict in the classroom?
Again, that kind of varied by community. So in many cases, you did see a lot of conflicts. In part, that's some communities did a better job than others in terms of preparing students, teachers, and communities for the stresses that desegregation was going to bring. And I think the larger point is that this was a lot to ask of communities, and it's something that was worthy to ask of them, that we had built a system of school segregation in the country over a period of decades, and it needed more than just a few years to work effectively.
Matthew, just in our last minute, we still have a lot of segregated districts today. In your work, what one lesson do you think we should pull out of what you've been talking about to try to solve these problems today?
The main lesson is that school segregation has never been accidental. It was a set of policy choices with regards to school zoning, school science, student assignment, and school funding. If we want to have a different set of outcomes with regards to school segregation in the present, we can make a different set of policy choices with those issues.
Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Matthew Delmont. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. And we've been looking at his latest book. It's called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
Coming up, a look at the Ecuadorian earthquake through the eyes of one Wisconsinite with a long history of working in that country. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, it's Latino USA on tonight's edition, a look at the racial politics of marijuana legalization and how the drug war has affected people of color.
First, Ecuador was rocked by a 7.8 magnitude earthquake this weekend, the strongest quake that the South American country has experienced in decades. As of today, the official death toll is nearly 500. It's expected to rise as searches for survivors buried in rubble stretch into a fourth day.
Ecuador's president says that rebuilding and recovery could cost billions of dollars. The country is already struggling due to the importance of oil in their national economy and historically low petroleum prices.
Beyond the long-term recovery, survivors have immediate needs as well. Spain's Red Cross said in the port city of Manta alone, as many as 5,000 people might need temporary housing because of destroyed homes. 100,000 need some sort of aid.
One Wisconsin nonprofit has a long history of providing health care in Ecuador, and they're ramping up their efforts to meet the needs of those impacted by the disaster. Dr. David Gauss is the co-founder of the Andean Health and Development Nonprofit Organization and has served as its executive director since 1994. Dr. Gauss, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, could we begin by having you tell us a little bit about where the earthquake hit and which parts of the country were most impacted?
The earthquake hit in the northwest corner of the country, right along the coast, in the Esmeraldas and Manabí provinces. The geography of Ecuador is such that the Andes Mountains run right down the middle of the country, and to the west of the Andes is a large flatland that is considered coastal, and that's where in the northern part of that region is where the earthquake hit.
Given that particular geography that you're describing, are there any particular challenges that come with recovery and aid efforts there?
Absolutely. As is the case with many earthquakes, Ecuador suffered two significant problems. One is that the collapsing of buildings included the collapsing of several hospitals, and so the medical relief efforts were frustrated, first of all, by that. Second of all, in these situations, oftentimes roads collapse, and this isn't just mudslides, but actually foundations give out, making transportation impossible initially and isolating the communities that are most impacted and in the greatest need.
Now, it's been several days after the quake, and Andean Health and Development operates two hospitals in provinces that are close to the earthquake epicenter. What are you hearing from your colleagues since the quake?
The needs are endless. The number of patients that we're seeing, since some of the roads have been fixed enough to make them passable, we're seeing a lot of the trauma that results from the crush injuries, broken bones, broken limbs, chest trauma, abdominal trauma, those things. The other thing that we're also seeing, in addition to the trauma from the earthquake, is that because a number of the government hospitals in those two provinces collapsed, there's still the regular types of things that occur for which people don't have access. So it's hard to imagine this, but in the midst of all the trauma patients we were taking care of, a young man came in with appendicitis, just picked the wrong day to give appendicitis and had to come to our facility to get that taken care of.
And so is your facility, and your facilities, I should say, are they able to help with some of these overflow of needs that are going on right now?
They are. So we're collaborating with the Ministry of Health and with the Social Security system to provide coverage to overflow patients that they're not able to take care of. And again, we're one of the first hospitals that you see when you come into the city of Santo Domingo from these affected areas. And so we've taken a number of those patients when they come in.
Well, as we said, you have a long history of working on health issues in Ecuador. And under normal circumstances, what are the areas of need that you see there, and how dire is the need?
Well, it's the typical things you see. So we have two hospitals. One of them is a 17-bed hospital. The other one is a 60-bed hospital. The kinds of things that we see are the typical things you'd see in a rural communities, particularly a low-income community. And then a couple of things that you wouldn't expect to see if you were in rural Wisconsin, for example. So the typical things are the childbirth, both complicated and uncomplicated. We see a lot of diarrheal disease with severe dehydration requiring IV rehydration and things like antibiotics. We get pneumonias. We have motor vehicle accidents, kidney infections, and skin infections. And those are the typical things, the things that you might not be accustomed to see in a place like in a rural hospital in Wisconsin, for example, would be typhoid fever, pesticide toxicity, snake bite, and a number of other tropical diseases unique to that area.
We're talking right now with Dr. David Gauss, executive director of the Andean Health and Development Nonprofit, which is based here in Wisconsin. And there are a couple of facilities serving people in Ecuador. And we're talking about efforts there to address the needs of survivors of last week's earthquake. And Dr. Gauss, how did you first get involved with Andean Health and Development? You're a co-founder. How did you end up with that role?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, but the short sarcastic answer is I went through my midlife crisis when I was a senior in college and decided I did not want to be an accountant, which was my major at that time. Went to volunteer in Ecuador at a family development project there for a few years after finishing my undergraduate studies. And that's when I met someone doing work in tropical disease and discovered that I would like to go into medicine. Came back and spent the next 11 years studying medicine and public health and tropical disease and family medicine specifically, and moved back to Ecuador in 1997 to start this project in this community. So that's actually how it all started.
Well, it sounds like you live in Wisconsin most of the time now, and you do serve as executive director there. What is it about Ecuador that compels you to go back and keep helping there?
The people. You, after living there for a few years, instead of seeing pictures in magazines about pain and suffering, these are now your friends and people that you've known for a long time. And so that has a different kind of impact on a person than seeing it in magazines or on television programs. They're wonderful people. It's a beautiful country. I work with a lot of very bright people. I'm the only American, the only person from the United States involved in this project in Ecuador. It's entirely Ecuadorian run. And we see ourselves as an organization, as a bridge to bring resources and certain kinds of know-how to a community. But largely, it's finding bright people in Ecuador and giving them the resources and the tools and the opportunities to provide, to do wonderful things for their own people. And that's what our goal has been. So our hospital goals, for example, are for them to be financially completely self-sustainable without depending on outside funding. The first one's there and the second one is on its way.
Now, there's been such a run of natural disasters in the world lately. In the last decade or so, there's been Japan, there has been Katrina, there has been Haiti. Do you think that we've learned lessons now about how to more effectively offer aid when events like this happen?
That's a wonderful question. I don't know if we have. I don't really know if we have. I think there's so many moving parts to the aid question. I think we can look to the experience in Haiti. That has not gone as well as one would have hoped. That probably was predictable after seeing Managua, Nicaragua, after its earthquake in 1972. 40 years later, there's still rubble left over from that earthquake. That city has not been rebuilt. I think these are very challenging problems that require not just technical solutions, which is oftentimes, I think, where we get bogged down in this country, thinking that it's largely a technical solution, when in fact it's oftentimes a political solution. It's a legal issue, among other things. So it's not just the technical piece. It's not just the money. There are so many other factors involved here. And so I think we continue to learn that lesson, but I'm hoping that we get better at it each and every time.
Is the earthquake in Ecuador getting the attention you'd like it to?
I think it's too early to tell. I'm not sure yet. Ecuador is a very resourceful country. They have a lot of the resources they need to be able to manage this. And I think that they will respond positively. If it depended on the colleagues that I work with in our two projects, I'd say Ecuador is in has a very high probability of emerging from this. However, they need money to be able to do this. They need outside resources. And one of the things that we're trying to offer as an organization is as a conduit for that. So all the care that we're providing, for example, for these patients, most of them are indigent patients that have nowhere else to turn. So the financial piece is still a significant part of this.
And just briefly, if people are listening to you now, they're moved to help, what can they do?
AndeanHealth.org is our website. We have an opportunity there for people to make contributions. In-kind contributions are useful. They're more difficult logistically to get into the country. Financial contributions obviously are very useful at this time. Every dollar that we bring in from those kinds of things goes directly to the country and goes directly to the people that we're taking care of. And the fact that I'm going there on Monday to oversee a lot of this is my personal guarantee that money does get spent the way that it was intended to be spent.
Dr. Gauss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here, and I look forward to talking again after coming back from Ecuador in a few weeks.
Dr. David Gauss is the co-founder and executive director of the Andean Health and Development Nonprofit, which is based here in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about their efforts to address the needs of survivors of last weekend's earthquake in Ecuador.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's National Parks Week, which means free admission to national parks across the country. 2016 is also the 100th anniversary of the founding of the National Park Service. And that got us thinking about exploring the great outdoors. As you look ahead to getting outdoors this year, maybe an epic trek through the American West, maybe a day trip closer to home, we want to hear where you're hoping to go.
Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your favorite national park, the visit you're always going to remember, the one you haven't been to yet but really want to get to someday, one that's great maybe to go to with kids. And, of course, here in Wisconsin, what's your favorite natural spot to visit? State Park, our National Forest, our National Lakeshore? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we've got some Facebook comments already. Sarah on Facebook says, all of them. We love Grand Teton National Park and enjoy taking less traveled hiking trails. Even walking half an hour past more touristy places is so amazing. I can't also wait to go back to the canyon area in Yellowstone National Park.
Also heard from Robin on the Central Time Facebook page. She suggests Zion and Yosemite for a once-in-a-lifetime experience. When I try to think which national parks I've been to, the list is disturbingly short, I got to say. I need to get out to more of them.
Same here. I love, though, the Lake Superior area, which is the National Lakeshore and the Apostle Islands there. That's fantastic. And on my list, Yellowstone, really high up. I have not been there, though.
Right. I would love to go there someday, too. Well, let's get to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Here's some of your favorite national parks and local natural areas. Pat starts us off in Oshkosh. Pat, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica.
What's your favorite?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's my favorite or not because I haven't seen them all. Like you, I'd like to see Yellowstone and Yosemite, but I was lucky to go to Crater Lake once. And actually twice. I was there. I left my wallet there. I had to go back again next weekend to get it.
Left your heart in San Francisco and your wallet in Crater Lake. That's in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
Pat, what is special about Crater Lake? Tell us about it.
Do you know anything about it at all? It's.
Sadly, no. I don't know anything about it.
Well, if I give you the 30-second sale here, it's an old volcano. So it's filled up, and the drive to it is really cool because it's all river valley, and then it opens up into this lava wasteland, and then you climb up the mountain, and you get to the top, and the color of the
wow.
Crater Lake is just, it's incredible. It's really a neat place to see.
It was about
a three-hour drive from Eugene, so it's really accessible.
Great. Well, thank you for telling us about it. That sounds fantastic.
And we'll go next to Joe in Madison. Joe, hi.
Good afternoon.
What parks do you have for us, Joe?
One of our favorite trips was the north rim of the Grand Canyon. We spent like 3 days there. It was just so different than the south rim. And then from there, we went to Zion, and then we did Bryce. And the three areas are so close, but so different. You know, your deep down canyon up to the high elevated stuff. And then at Zion, you do the Narrows walk up the river. Just unbelievable.
Wow, that is another trip that I want to do. We're talking maybe fly into Vegas, I guess, and then get out of Vegas and go to all these amazing natural areas.
That sounds great, Joe. Thank you so much for that. A super quick one, maybe next from Kathy. Kathy, hi.
Hi. My favorite is Mount Rushmore. I've been there at least five times in my life, and every time is thrilling. You come up to all those woods, you're walking through those woods, and you come around the corner, and there's all those four huge faces, and they're beautiful, and it's amazing.
Yeah, that must be really spectacular. Yeah, that's another one on my list. Road trip.
Well, thank you. We got to do a Central Time road trip. All right, show's off tomorrow. We're hitting we'll be back tomorrow.
Nice
but
try.
You can keep sharing your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. Also heard from Chris on Facebook who says Gulf Shores National Park comes to mind, or even El Yunque National Rainforest. Smile emoticon. The only tropical rainforest of the U.S. National Park System, Chris says, in Puerto Rico. That's one I actually have been lucky enough to go to.
Well, thank you so much for all these calls, and you can keep these great ideas coming over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Creators of an 8-foot-high video internet link in Milwaukee hope to help people connect with residents of Newark, New Jersey. Similar links called portals have been used between countries, but the portal that's opened in a carpeted railroad shipping container in Milwaukee this week is apparently the first to connect two U.S. cities. Chuck Krumbach went for a look and a listen.
Technology like Skype lets people sitting in front of their computers see each other via the internet. The new portal in Milwaukee is like a giant Skype box. The screen is 8 feet high and 8 feet wide, and the steel cargo container holding it is about 15 feet long. It has a wide-angle camera lens, too, which lets users see a room full of people on the other end. Both portals are in African-American neighborhoods.
The name of my blog is Urban Girl Magazine.
That led to a revelation for a Newark woman named Desiree during one of the first chats yesterday.
And I didn't know so many black people was in Milwaukee.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Why, you watched that Laverne and Shirley, and you thought that's how it was, huh?
While the dialogues can be fun, that's not the only hope of the team that put together the installations. The Milwaukee portal is outside a youth center in the city's Amani neighborhood, a low-income area dealing with a substantial amount of crime. Community organizer Dennis Walton says he partly wanted the portal as a way to trade ideas with Newark on how to reduce violence.
Whatever we can do to promote safety, you know, and when we learn that, you know, some of the things that are happening in our community are the same things that people are dealing with in their neighborhoods and their communities, and we can talk about the experiences and, you know, what works for them, what works for us.
Yeah, I got a question.
Okay.
Inside the portal container, a Newark resident asked Walton about helping prison parolees.
Yeah, I want to know what type of programs that you have down there for reentry, for people that's returning back to the community.
Walton responded that he's co-director of the Milwaukee Fatherhood Initiative.
Currently, one of the things that I do is I work within the Department of Corrections, working with inmates, teaching them about fatherhood classes, preparing them. We help them with child support issues. We help them with driver's license issues to make sure that when guys are coming home, we're removing some of the barriers, you know, from their situation so that they won't keep going back into incarceration.
The portal chats are also expected to be about the arts. A woman from Newark named Kim asked about young Milwaukee performers coming to the portal. Mikkel Floyd Pruitt replied he'll be helping program Milwaukee performances on Saturdays.
So I look forward to having some interesting interactions between some of our artists and some of the artists there at the same time. So maybe we can come up with some new artworks using the portal.
Absolutely.
All right.
School groups and arts organizations can also use the Milwaukee portal to connect with other parts of the world, and the units in Milwaukee and Newark will be open for focused dialogues 3 days a week. Amar Bakshi of the Washington, D.C.-based group Shared Studios devised the portals. He hopes the two-month operation in Milwaukee is meaningful.
I mean, anyone could use Facebook Messenger to talk to someone in Rwanda, but you don't really have a moment to do it. It's not clear why, or there's no context. So this is providing a bit of a context for that, for people to indulge that basic human curiosity and maybe to spark it a little more, too.
A foundation grant is helping pay for the Milwaukee and Newark portals. Researchers at Yale and at Rutgers in New Jersey plan to analyze edited conversations about police-community relations. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as new generations come of age with unprecedented access to pornography, our guest says there are rising concerns about porn's long-term effects on men.
We'll hear about a project here in Wisconsin, a new camp that's trying to help girls learn the basics of using power tools.
And with the results from the New York primary in hand, as they will be by tomorrow, we're going to check in with 538's Harry Enten about the latest in the race for the White House. Check out winners and losers and where the race stands now that we'll have another big delegate chunk in the House.
And listen to WPR.org tonight starting at 8 for live coverage of those New York primary results. And hear more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.